And that's fine. And now, either give me... Now, the so-called conjunction, getting the green and the tea together, means that, of course, you just can't look for green things and you can't look for teas. You've got to look for the conjunction of the two together. That takes longer. And you remember I said that you always put in a control where there's no letter there at all, and that's this curve. And notice, if there's no letter there at all, there are 30 things, it takes you an extra 2 seconds, which is a long time on this timescale, an extra 2 seconds to press the button. But if it is there, it takes roughly, these two slopes are roughly in the ratio of 2 to 1, it takes half the time, allowing for this bit here, and so on. Now, the model that would spring to mind there is that you're doing a random search. Something in your brain is doing a random search when you're looking for the green tea. And of course, if it isn't there, you've got to look at all the letters. And if it is there, with luck, you'll find, on an average, you'll find it in half the time. So expect the time to be shorter. And this one simply is the same thing, show that if it's a difficult task, things take longer. If it's an easy task, things can be a bit quicker. Okay, so I think we can have the slide off and the lights up now. Now, you've always often had, or many of you will have had, an experience not unlike that in of pop-out, is that you open a book, or a newspaper is the more common thing, and the word McGill or whatever it is pops out at you. But you often have that, when you have that experience, you don't know where it was. You're pretty sure you saw it, and actually if you look, it commonly happens to people with their own name. They're the sort of people who get their names in the newspaper. But you don't know quite where it was, but you usually can find it. Now, what Anne Treisman has shown, it's the same in this case for letters, although I'll explain that it isn't always like that, that when you ask people, you know, was there something that popped out, we're going back to pop out now, like the letter S, they'll, and this is when you flash it for a short time, not the way I did it, you flash it and mask and so on, and there's an array, and they said, yes, the S was there, where was it? Oh, well, it was in the top right-hand corner, but usually it's 40% of the time it's somewhere else. In other words, they don't know exactly where it was, although they think they do. When she first did this experiment on herself, she was disappointed because she kept finding, she predicted, because she had a theory about this, she wouldn't know where it was. She kept thinking, gosh, I got it right every time. But when she came to look at the results, when she looked at the protocol, you know, because she was sitting in front of a machine, it was going into the computer and so on, she found she'd made about 40% of mistakes. So you actually do think you know where it is, but the evidence is against you about half the time. Now, the other thing that she has shown, and some of this work is either, I'm going to tell you about now, is either unpublished or in the course of publication, I'm not quite sure how far it's got, is that you can show that pop-out is asymmetrical. So one typical thing, and I'm sorry I don't have a slide of this, you have about 20 or 30 objects, and they're all, or all but one is going to be, circles of about the identical size, scattered about in a semi-random way. So it's not a regular way, and it's not purely random, but it's sort of not clumped or anything special like that. And one of them is a circle of the same diameter, but a bit cut out, so it's like a letter C. It's just an incomplete circle, for example. And if you do the tests on that and do the time that it takes to see it against the number of distractors, the number of all the objects and so on, clearly a case of pop-out, so the C will pop out against the partial circles will pop out against the complete circle. Now you can do the experiment the other way around. You do another experiment where all the objects are circles which are incomplete and there's one complete circle, and there you have to search. It doesn't pop out at you. So she says that What that means is, or what it implies, we have to be a little careful here, is that a terminator, that the end of a line, this is what Bailey-Yildiz has also concluded, I think previously in other experiments, that the terminator is a textron, namely something that pops out, but completeness is not. Now, it turns out that logically it's much easier to say what isn't a textron, because it doesn't pop out, than what is, because when something pops out, it doesn't tell you what is popping out, you have to infer that. There's an extra step. And sometimes the results are quite bizarre. You get asymmetrical pop-out, I won't go through the whole rigmarole, between curved lines, curved little segments, and straight lines, either the same length as this or the same length as that, and it turns out that a curved line will pop out against straight ones, but an odd straight line won't pop out against curved ones, which leads to a very remarkable conclusion that curvature is a textron, but straightness is not. It's an absence of curvature. Now, whether that will stand up with further experiments remains to be seen. But it does show the results are not something which you could automatically predict. Now, this is, at this point, the story gets a trifle complicated, because Yildiz and Treisman at this coming point don't quite agree. And I think that I don't think it's either of them have made a mistake in the experiments. They're doing slightly different experiments. So let's now turn to Bailey-Yildiz's experiments, which are due to come out in Science any week now. Now, what it is another one of these flash and mask experiments, and the background consists of inclined lines, the distractors, all of the same orientation. And what you're going to ask is there a vertical line there? And we'll just take the simple case at the moment and say it was the one vertical line. And I need hardly tell you, as you can almost imagine some of these experiments, you flash it and the vertical line pops out at you. Okay? Now you can do it again. And actually, you can do it, as long as they're not too near together in the display, you can do it for two vertical lines, and you can say there's two and not one or three, and so on. Again, you're not quite sure you've seen it, but damn it, you seem to get the right answer. And then you can perhaps do it with three. Okay. Now, you can do just the same thing again with another set of experiments with horizontal lines. Okay. And you can say whether it's two or three. But if you're asked, you know, if he gives you one vertical and two horizontal, and you're asked to say, are they all the same? In other words, can you tell the difference between vertical and horizontal? You can't tell. In other words, in his system, you can tell where something is, very roughly, where something is, but you can't tell what it is that's popping out. But in the newspaper one, where it's a word, it's the other way around. You can say what popped out because you recognize the word, but you can't say where it is. Now, we don't know. What we believe is that Bailey-Yildiz's one is at an early stage in the visual system, where what inclined lines are, and of course words come much further up in the system. We don't quite know where. And probably that's the difference. But we have to wait until they've extended their protocols. So that's why I say it's a little complicated. Now, both of them have made the same theoretical model to explain their result, or nearly the same. I'm going to treat them as if they're the same. Now, remember, this is a model made with very little reference to what is supposed to be inside your head. Is just a compact description of the result. That's what this model means. And what they think of is that, first of all, they say there will be quite a number of different textrons. Now, we don't know the number. For example, we do think that the textrons for shape, some of them, are oriented lines or blobs of some sort, terminators, where the line ends, as in that letter C. Yildiz thinks that possibly a cross is a textron, and Treisman isn't so sure. But there's almost certainly other things like movement and seeing in depth and color, which have not been explored, but everybody feels do pop out. In fact, the color is very easy to demonstrate if the difference in color is big enough. So they like to think there are a series of different maps, one, say, for oriented blobs, perhaps another one for terminators, one for color, one for movement, one for depth, and so on. All these are, remember, this is for early pre-attentive vision. This is the theoretical model. You have all these maps, and they project to one single map, which you might call the pop-out map. And it's what happens here which enables you to press the button. That's got to go to the motor system. Remember, there's nobody looking at it, but something has got to press the button, or put words, make say something in speech, which is another, remember, motor output. That's what they would like to believe is the system. And the interesting thing, of course, is that it's possible that this map will have lost information. This would explain Ulysses' results, for example. The map up here, which detected that there was an odd orientation there, remember I said it had to be a gradient, it merely means the odd things stand out. It's like a center surround feature detector is what you want, which incidentally we now know exists in the brain. That when you have that, it will send a signal down to say there is something more or less in that position, but it appears to have lost the information what the orientation is. That's from his point of view. We'll come to hers in a minute. And so it's reasonable to ask, where could this map be? Where could there be in the brain? Now, we don't know, of course, where all these text on maps are. You could make an argument they're all in the primary visual cortex, because everything you remember in a primate has to go through the primary visual cortex in order to get to the other ones. You could argue, no, there are pop-out features which must come later on, and that must be surely true for words, which, remember, are a little bit different, so we have to be cautious in putting these two things together. So what we're looking for in the neuroanatomy is a place probably where all the visual systems project on top of each other in some way. And could we guess what that place is? Well, there's one place, I'm not going to bore you with all too many details of neuroanatomy, there's one place called the claustrum, which is just under the cortex, a bit on each side, and so on, which does get a projection from all the early visual areas. They do project on top of one another, but if you look at what the cells in the claustrum are interested in by putting an electrode in and shining things, you find they're very interested in orientation. They particularly like long lines, for example. And the other thing is, with minor reservations, it only goes back to the cortex. It doesn't got to get out anywhere. Now, that doesn't look very favorable. So you would perhaps, if you were to look systematically, you might look at that place last. But is there a place which looks a little more favorable? It turns out there is the part of the brain which was the old visual system, what is called the tectum in certain lower vertebrates, and in you is called the superior colliculus, and nowadays is largely concerned with eye movements. It's the system that work out there's something interesting there and does the coding for where you should move your eyes in a jump, a so-called saccade, although it doesn't. Its messages have to be decoded as to what the actual instructions in detail should be. Now, when you look there, the upper layers of this structure are highly visual. They get an input from all the early visual areas, including the first one, which has orientation. But if you put electrodes into the cells there, they don't know what orientation is. It's presumably been averaged out when it comes into this map. So that's a very favorable place to look. And so now we have a concrete question we can ask. Does pop-out go through the superior colliculus, which would be favorable in many ways? Now, I want to tell you there are one or two other places. There are one or two places in what's called the pulvina, and there may be one in the striatum. It's not a definite thing, but at least we can point the finger from using these theoretical ideas at the bit of the animal's brain that should be looked at. And so now, it really is, I mean, I expect people have already started to do this experiment because it's now been obvious for the last so many months of taking what's called an alert behaving monkey, it's It's no use doing these things on a monkey under an anesthetic, or it has to be an alert behaving monkey, and of course it has to be trained. Normally the monkey is trained to fixate a certain spot there, and if it does a task, which it's trained over so many months, it gets a little reward. You may think the monkeys don't like this very much, but I must tell you about monkeys. It turns out that different sorts of monkeys have different social structures. And some sorts of monkeys, there is a leader, I mean there's a pecking order and there's a leader that has to be obeyed, and the other one, it's just a tiny family group and there's no special leader. The macaque monkey is one of the former ones. Now, the great advantage of a monkey like that is that it begins to treat the experimenter as a leader. And so on. So it will, you know, want to do things to please the experimenter, and if somebody comes in, it gets a bit cross, and, you know, I want to get on with the experiment, and so on. It doesn't like that. Whereas the other sort of monkeys are much more laid back, and, you know, who needs it, you see? And you all know this difference, because one of the major differences between cats and dogs,